Okay, if you would turn your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 25. Isaiah chapter 25. I think I'll read the whole chapter. It's only 12 verses. And we'll go from there. Beginning in verse 1. O Lord, thou art my God. I will exalt thee. I will give thanks to thy name. For thou hast worked wonders, plans formed long ago with perfect faithfulness. For thou hast made a city into a heap, a fortified city into ruin, a palace of strangers is a city no more, it will never be rebuilt. Therefore a strong people will glorify thee, cities of ruthless nations will revere thee, for thou hast been a defense for the helpless, a defense for the needy in his distress, a refuge from the storm, a shade from the heat, for the breath of the ruthless is like a rainstorm against the wall, like heat in drought, thou dost subdue the uproar of aliens. Like heat by the shadow of a cloud, the song of the ruthless is silenced. And the Lord of hosts will prepare a lavish banquet for all peoples on this mountain, a banquet of aged wine, choice pieces with marrow, and refined aged wine. And on this mountain he will swallow up the covering which is over all peoples, even the veil which is stretched over all nations. He will swallow up death for all time. The Lord God will wipe tears away from all faces, and he will remove the reproach of his people from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. And it will be said in that day, Behold, this is our God for whom we have waited, that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. For the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain, and Moab will be trodden down in his place, as straw is trodden down in the water of a manure pile. And he will spread out his hands in the middle of it, and as a swimmer spreads out his hands to swim. But the Lord will lay low his pride together with the trickery of his hands, and the unassailable fortifications of your walls he will bring down, lay low, and cast to the ground, even to the dust. Last week in chapter 24, we went through the chapter 24, which was showing God as a God of wrath and judgment. And it talked about the coming judgment of the day of the Lord and the tribulation and the end times. And today we're going to look at this psalm as a song of praise for God's goodness and God's victory. God is a victorious God and God is a good God. And here we have a song of praise and celebration of all that God is doing. Now, I want to set the context of what's going on in the book of Isaiah. And I think it's very important that we understand this. When you look, a lot of what we're going through in the book of Isaiah is looking to a future time of God's judgment and a future time of God's restoration. And it's very important as you look at the coming kingdom, the Messianic kingdom, that you understand that all the way through the Old Testament, what they were looking forward to was a Messiah that would reign on earth. That's what they were looking forward to. Now, it's easy for us today because in our teaching and our preaching and throughout Christianity, all we talk about is the desire to go to heaven. That the ultimate goal is to go to heaven. And when we talk about it, that's what we all want to do. We want to die. When we die, we want to go to heaven. And it's true that that Paul said, absence from the body is presence with the Lord. And Paul said, it's far better for me to die and to be in heaven than it is to be here on earth. But the ultimate goal is not to be in heaven. The ultimate goal is to be free from sin and free from this body of flesh. The ultimate goal is to be glorified in God's presence and have God's kingdom reign forever and ever. So sometimes we get this idea that we want to go to heaven because heaven's wonderful and great, and it is. But the goal is to be glorified and to be like God, perfect in righteousness and holiness. And when you look at the Bible, it is really a conquest or a program of God that goes on earth that God is dealing with the conflict between good and evil. And so when he starts out, he says, O Lord, thou art my God. I will exalt thee. I will give thanks to thy name, for thou hast worked wonders, plans formed long ago with perfect faithfulness. In other words, he talks about who God is. In the Bible, when it begins, it says, in the beginning, God. It doesn't give a reason for God. It doesn't give an explanation for God. It just says, in the beginning, God. God is God. And by definition, God is the supreme being, eternal, perfect in righteousness, perfect in knowledge and understanding, knows all things, is all powerful, can do all things. So if that's the definition of God, and this is who the God is of the Bible, then it just lays it out there that the eternal God is the one who has performed all things and has purposed all things to be done. He starts out with that. That's the God I worship. That's the God I know is the God of creation, the God of all power, the God of all holiness, the God of all righteousness, the God who performs everything he sets out to perform without fail. He is faithful to carry out every purpose and plan he has ever purposed. And so what you have is, he says there in the last verse of chapter 24, he says, and the moon will be abashed and the sun ashamed, for the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and his glory will be before his elders. He ends the chapter 24 with the reigning king in Jerusalem on the throne, reigning on earth. And so what you have in the Bible, and that's why to me it's so important that we understand how important it is to understand the reason for the messianic kingdom and the reign, because so many people have discounted that. And to me, the Bible doesn't even make sense without that. Because what you have is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And I believe that God created a perfect heaven and earth in the beginning. And that heaven and earth was corrupted by the sin and the fall of Satan. And then I believe that after the sin and fall of Satan and the corruption of the perfect heaven and earth in Genesis 1:1, you have an earth that's covered with darkness and water, and God recreates out of that corrupted earth a new earth for Adam and Eve, and in 6 days he made it perfect like it was for Adam and Eve, but it still had light and darkness, it still had oceans, it's not like it will be in Revelation 21:22. So between Genesis 1:1 and Revelation 21, where you have the eternal new earth and heaven, you have this program of God being carried out on earth, dealing with the conflict between good and evil, between Satan and God, and between the kingdom of goodness or godness and the kingdom of darkness and wickedness. And you have this progression of that conflict that's being carried out. And so when you get to the book of Revelation, it is the conclusion of that conflict to usher in not only the messianic age, but then the eternal age in Revelation 21, 22. And so that's why it's so important that as you go through the book of Isaiah, everything that Isaiah is dealing with and everything that we're dealing with is going to culminate with the second coming of Christ. And the second coming of Christ will bring an end to all these things that has been building up toward that climax or that conclusion of God's kingdom on earth. And even when you look at the Lord's Prayer in Matthew chapter 6, he says, therefore, do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask. Pray then in this way, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Now, what does he mean by that, that thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven? God's will is always done, right? God's will is never thwarted. But right now, unrighteousness and wickedness and lawlessness is the rule of the day. So when he says, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, how's God's will done in heaven? In righteousness. So the prayer is that there's coming a day in a kingdom when God's will, God's righteousness, will permeate the earth. And God's righteousness will reign on earth like it reigns in heaven. That's not the way it is now. Sin and lawlessness reigns on earth. And during this time that God's bringing out His bride, His church, and He's calling out the church into faith, at this time, we still have a problem because Satan is the god of this world. And because of that, you look at that, and Satan has dominion now. A couple of passages dealing with Satan's rule and Satan's dominion during this time starts out in Luke chapter 4 when we're looking at the temptation of Jesus. When God recreated the earth in the 6 days, when He created Adam and Eve and He put them in the garden, and the first thing you see is Satan shows up as the fallen angel of deceit and lying and desiring to corrupt God's newly formed earth and His newly formed people on earth. And so He comes to Adam and Eve, and He deceives Eve, and Adam goes along and sins and gives over the dominion that God had given to Adam and Eve to rule the earth. He gives it to Satan. And Satan acknowledges this in Luke chapter 4 when he's tempting Jesus. Jesus comes as the second Adam, and so he immediately goes to the second Adam to try to get him to fall like the first Adam fell. And so Jesus says in verse 4, it says, Jesus answered, "It is written, man shall not live on bread alone. And He led him up and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil said to Him, I will give you all this domain and its glory, for it has been handed over to Me, and I give it to whomever I wish. Therefore, if you worship before Me, it shall all be yours." Satan wants to be worshipped. He wants to be like God. The sin from the beginning was he wanted to elevate himself up to be God. The pride rose up in him, and he wanted to be like God. He wanted to be worshipped like God. He wanted people to worship him. And so here comes the second Adam, Jesus Christ, whom God has ordained as My begotten Son, and acknowledged that when John the Baptist baptized him, this is My beloved Son in whom I well please. God acknowledges this was the Christ, the Messiah. And Satan immediately, Jesus has led him to the wilderness to be tempted of Satan, to be tested by Satan, to prove whether he was truly the Son of God or not. And Satan immediately offers him the kingdoms of the world because they've been handed over to him. And so Satan is the god of this world who is over the nations of the world. He is the king over the nations of the world. And you saw that in Isaiah 14 when he was the king behind the king of Tyre. And in Ezekiel 28, of Babylon. And in Ezekiel 28, he is the king behind the king. He is the one who is the ruler of this world, the ruler of this earth, and he is the one who has dominion right now at this time. You saw that in Ephesians when he's talking about our coming to faith, that we were too under this same dark rulership or the dark kingdom of the world. He says in chapter 2 of Ephesians 1, he says, "You were dead in your trespasses and sins in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working the sons of disobedience. Among them too we all formerly lived in the lust of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and the mind, and were by nature the children of wrath, even as the rest." So when we were born in this world, we're born in a state of sin and transgressions and depravity, and we're walking according to the prince of the power of the air. The prince of the power of the air is Satan. It says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. He says, "Therefore, since we have this ministry, as we have received mercy, we do not lose heart." 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1. "But we have renounced the things hidden because of shame, not walking in craftiness or adulterating the word of God, but by the manifestation of truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, in whose case the god of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving, that they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God." So here again, Paul acknowledges that the ones that are unbelieving and the ones that are lost are blinded by the god of this world, who is deceiving them into continuing in that state of darkness and continuing in their being under the prince of the power of the air and the deception that he so easily brings upon the world. Then in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he goes on to state that he's dealing with false teachers and false prophets, Paul is. And he says, "For such men are false apostles," in verse 13 of chapter 11 of 2 Corinthians, for such men are false apostles, deceitful workers, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ, and no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. Therefore, it is not surprising if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteous, whose end shall be according to their deeds. And again, the method that Satan works in this world is deception, to deceive people to think that he is something that he's not. And he deceives people into thinking that they can be right and do the things that Satan encourages them to do. And this is brought out in the conclusion of his kingdom in the time of the Antichrist by what it says in 2 Thessalonians 2 about the Antichrist. It says in verse 8 of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, it says, and then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders. Satan has the ability to deceive through signs, through power and false wonders. And that's why people are looking for some revelation, some experience, some sign, some miracle. Satan will be glad to accommodate them and give them something that they would be deceived by. And that's what will happen with the Antichrist. He will have great power, and the world will be deceived greatly through the deception and the power of Satan. So Satan's kingdom begins basically at the Tower of Babel. Do you remember what happened at the Tower of Babel? We had just come out of the flood, and the earth had been repopulated on earth through the sons of Noah, Japheth, Shem, and Ham. And their children had populated the earth, and they were all living in the same area of Babylon. And they came together, and Satan caused them to decide and to want to build this tower up to heaven to prove that they were worthy to be worshipped, that they were their own God. And it was Satan wanting to be worshipped. And so he wanted all the people of the earth to come together as one people and basically worship him. So it begins at the Tower of Babel. And then you go to the times of the Gentiles that God ordained as a way to punish Israel because of their infidelity and their sin. And so you begin the times of Babylon, times of the Gentile nations, where Satan is still controlling these kings. And the first one is what? Of the times of the Gentiles. What's the first king that dominated Israel and came in and took them captive? Nebuchadnezzar. It was, again, the Babylonian king. So here you have the progression of Satan's kingdom that began at the Tower of Babel, and it begins again in the times of Gentiles in Daniel's prophecy with Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar as the head of this times of the Gentiles, this progression of Gentile kingdoms that is controlled by Satan. And so Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon is the head of that times of the Gentiles, and then it flows through the other nations that God rises up to have sway over Jerusalem and over Israel. And what's the last king of Satan's kingdom? The Antichrist. So you get to the book of Revelation, and it talks about in chapter 17 and chapter 18 in the book of Revelation, it talks about Babylon. In chapter 17, it talks about the mystery woman, this harlot that's called Babylon, Mystery Babylon. And so we find that is the religious system that Satan puts in place for the first half of the tribulation, in which the whole world comes together in one world religion, and their main goal is to crucify or to destroy anyone that would name the name of Christ during that time. And that's why in Revelation 17, when it's talking about this harlot, this mystery Babylon, this woman, he's talking about that religious system. It says in verse, In verse 2, it says, verse 3, and he said, He carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and the woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations of the unclean things of her immorality, and upon her forehead a name written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus, and when I saw her, I wondered greatly. So here's a picture of this great religious system that sits on the approval of the world political system that she sits on it says there, I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast having full of blasphemous names, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And that beast refers to the political system of the Antichrist in the first half of the tribulation, where there's 10 nations that he is controlling. And then the second half, he kills 3 of those 10 kings, and the other 7 give their allegiance to him. And so the second half, he is in full dictatorship mode of the earth. But during the first half, he endorses this world religious system that will crucify and kill the ones that name the name of Christ during the first half of the tribulation. And that's the ones that are found in Revelation chapter 5. The martyrdom of the saints that come out of the Great Tribulation are killed by this harlot, this false religious system. Right.
I just want to point out the obvious. The turmoil since Trump took office is all around globalism versus nationalism. I mean, Satan is at work and it's accelerated rapidly. One world government, pluralism, you know, you can't exclude anybody. I mean, it's crazy, but that's the worldview that we're dealing with. And you're not going to change it by apologizing or something.
Just as a side note to what was just said about the current situation in the world, I was thinking this morning when I was going through this that, not saying anything about the goodness or the badness of President Trump, I'm just talking about the concepts. If I was born in 1953, which shows you how old I am. But anyway, at that time, if anyone had even thought or brought up the idea of banning radical Muslims from our country, or if anybody had thought about the fact that abortion was evil or wrong, or anybody thought about a lot of the things that are being protested today is so bad, people would have thought she's crazy. In the 1950s and 60s, it wouldn't have been thought to be a bad thing to be careful who you let in the country, or to be embracing of things that are obviously forbidden in the scriptures, whether it's homosexuality or, I mean, gay marriage would have been a thought of, that would be absurd to even think that would happen. So the very things that are being promoted with this president that people are so up in arms about, 50 years ago, it wouldn't even have been thought as being abnormal. It would have been, that's the way it should be. It just shows you how far the world has progressed and how avid the opposition to goodness and godliness is out there, and the push for lawlessness is so rampant. And what I think you see happening with President Trump and with the British Brexit vote is the panic and the all-out assault by the globalists to stop this movement so that the globalist movement can get back on track. And that's what Satan is behind, is a globalist movement to bring in the time of this. I do believe that every indication is that we are approaching the very end. And that's why it's so important as we go through the book of Isaiah to realize that this was God's purpose and plan to bring about the second coming of Christ and to bring in an age of the Messiah that was predicted and pronounced. And it's very important that you see that. So right now, we're entering in the last stages, I believe, of Satan's kingdom on earth. And so as in the Bible says in Revelation 13, when Satan is cast down out of heaven, has no longer access to go to heaven, and he has 3.5 years left to reign and be the God of this world, he goes all out assault to try to destroy all the people of God. And that's what we'll see here as we look in Isaiah, and then in, again in the end of the book. All right, look in Isaiah again in 25. Again, verse 1, the plans that were formed long ago, it means the preordained, before the foundation of the world, purpose and plan of God includes all these things that are going on today. And God is faithful to bring about a conclusion to everything He has purposed and planned. And He has laid out His plans and His purposes through the prophecies of the Old Testament and through the revelation of Jesus Christ in the New Testament. He has laid out clearly His purposes and plans, and He will be faithful to carry them out completely because He is a God of His Word, and He always does what He purposes to do. In verse 2, it says, "Thou hast made a city into a heap, a fortified city into ruin, a palace of strangers is a city no more. It will never be rebuilt." And I think that is a direct reference to Revelation 18, when the city of Babylon, Satan's final city, his final kingdom city that the Antichrist rules from, will be completely destroyed and annihilated. And that's what you have in the book of Revelation chapter 18, is the complete destruction of the kingdom of Satan. Now, looking at that kingdom, in chapter 13 of Revelation, Satan finally gets what he has sought for the entire human history. It says in chapter 13 of Revelation, verse 3, speaking of the Antichrist, it said, "I saw one of his heads as it had been slain, and his